From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we discuss the possibility of war with Joel Brinkley, Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. Also, jazz guitarist and singer John Pizzarelli tells us how he got his start playing with his father, the guitarist Bucky Pizzarelli. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews two popular records by Fakes, the rapper Vanilla Ice and the cartoon characters The Simpsons. And TV critic David Bianculli checks out a couple of new mid-season replacement shows. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Bush has confirmed that the Iraqis have accepted his offer for talks between Secretary of State James Baker and Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz. He says the talks will be held in Geneva on Wednesday, January 9th. The president calls today's word from Baghdad a useful step.
I hope that Iraq's acceptance of the meeting indicates a growing awareness of the seriousness of the situation and a willingness to heed the international community's will as expressed in 12 United Nations Security Council resolutions.
The president says Secretary Baker's mission will be to convey the gravity of the situation to the Iraqis, along with the determination of the international coalition aligned against them. An Iraqi presidential envoy says that if there's war in the Persian Gulf, Iraq will blow up all of the oil installations in the Saudi Peninsula, not just those in Kuwait. Some scientists are warning that the destruction of the oil fields would result in fires that last for a year and cause a global ecological disaster. The envoy says Iraq won't initiate a war, but will respond if the multinational force gathered in Saudi Arabia starts one. We will probably soon be paying more to mail a first-class letter. The Postal Rate Commission is recommending a 4-cent increase on first-class letters to 29 cents. That's 1 cent less than the nickel hike requested by the Postal Service. NPR's Carol Ann Clark has more.
The real differences between the Commission and the Postal Service on the new rate schedule revolve around who should pay more, individuals or businesses, Commission Chairman George Haley.
The Commission strongly disagrees with and has therefore rejected the service's proposal to shift yet more of the burden of recovering institutional costs onto first class.
The commission is recommending that the charge for third-class advertising mail be raised by 25%. The commission would also create a new 27-cent rate for the public when it uses special bar-coded reply envelopes to pay bills. The Postal Service Board of Governors can now accept, reject, or put the proposed rates into effect under protest. Under the normal course of events, the new rates would go into effect sometime next month. I'm Carol Ann Clark in Washington.
In December, the number of people out of work reached its highest level in more than 3 years, according to the Labor Department. The unemployment rate was 6.1% last month. The Bank of New England says it expects to report a fourth-quarter loss of up to $450 billion. The troubled bank has been hit hard by falling real estate values and a slowing economy, leaving it with a large number of problem loans. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 11.13 points at 2562.38. Trading is light. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Israel is trying to stay out of the conflict in the Gulf, but Saddam Hussein seems determined to bring Israel into it. My guest Joel Brinkley is the Jerusalem bureau chief of the New York Times. Today is the last day of his 3-week vacation in the U.S. Tomorrow he returns to Israel. Before he goes, we asked him to talk with us about the Gulf crisis from his vantage point in Jerusalem. I asked him if he thought there was going to be a war.
Well, all of us who follow this change our views about once a week. And I think at this point I would guess that there's about a 60% chance of war. The two sides seem to have painted themselves into such tight corners, as we all can see, that unless Saddam Hussein does something that we don't anticipate, which is possible, I don't see much alternative to war. However, Saddam has shown the capability to do a 180-degree turn at any moment without any prediction for it, and that's still possible.
Do you think that there's more that President Bush could be doing to prevent a war?
Well, at this point, I don't know what he can do without changing radically changing the policy he has set for himself. Some of us may argue with how he got to this point, but once he got to this point, there doesn't seem to be much way to back away from it. It does look as if he's going to engineer some sort of direct talks, but I don't think anybody believes much is going to result from them, and I'm not sure that the Bush administration really wants anything to result from them.
You'll soon be heading back to Israel. Israel believes that if there is a war, Iraq would launch at least 20 missiles against Israel, conventional or chemical warheads, and that some of them would inevitably penetrate Israeli defenses. Well, can you give us a sense of the debate in Israel now over what the military options would be there if Israel was attacked?
First of all, even if Iraq does launch missiles against Israel, the missiles they have that are capable of reaching Israel have been altered to such a degree to enhance the range that their payloads are quite small, and they would not do a great deal of damage. Israel is hit by missiles relatively frequently from Lebanon, and hardly anyone is ever hurt by them. The Iraqi missiles may hit targets that kill people, but nobody in Israel believes that the missiles would be anything except a serious nuisance. They would not threaten the state. Israel it has, as far as I can tell, absolutely no interest in getting into a direct war with Iraq. If they were struck by Iraqi missiles, I think the most they would do is retaliate by taking out the missile launchers. I don't think they'd go beyond that and risk something larger, given that Israel, just as the Arab nations, would much rather have the United States take on Iraq than do it themselves.
If there's no real fear in Israel of a really extensive missile attack, why does everyone in Israel have a gas mask?
The gas masks were passed out largely to, there are a couple of reasons. It was really for public confidence, and a larger reason is that if they have to mobilize the forces and send most adult men to the front should a larger war break out, they don't want the men at the front worried about their families back in Tel Aviv being defenseless should there be a chemical attack. So it is as much to give the troops confidence as it is to protect Israelis. And it is true that if Iraq launches missiles and they land in a populated area for a block or two, each missile might disperse chemicals that could hurt or kill people. But it would be a fairly rarefied number of spots that actually are directly affected by these missiles.
Do you have a gas mask?
Yes.
Where do you keep it?
In a closet.
How much faith do you have in it if you were subjected to a chemical or biological attack?
I'm not, frankly, that worried about a chemical or biological attack. And I have it mainly because my wife wanted it, but most of the chemicals I know that they use settle to the ground fairly quickly, and if a missile landed in my living room, of course I'd be in trouble, but if it landed on my square block and if people are indoors and have their windows closed, it's relatively unlikely that they would be greatly harmed by the gas.
Did Palestinians ever get issued gas masks in Israel?
The Israelis offered Palestinians gas masks but required them to pay for them, and most Palestinians decided they didn't want them, weren't willing to pay for them. I think the charge was about $20. The Israelis say that the Israeli people paid for their gas masks in their taxes and the Palestinians didn't, although the Palestinians too pay Israeli taxes. So they have the opportunity to get them but have chosen not to, and in fact quite a number of them parade around on the West Bank urging Saddam Hussein to attack Israel with chemical gas and say that they'd be willing to take the risks should that occur.
Judging from the recent string of murders by Israelis and Palestinians, hatred between Palestinians and Israelis is perhaps at an all-time high. What do you think?
I've been there 3 years and know people who obviously have been there quite a bit longer, and I have never experienced or know of anybody who's experienced such a dark period in Jewish-Israeli or Israeli-Arab relations within the state. It's quite depressing, rather dangerous, and the level of hatred has descended to a point that I think is unprecedented, and many people think cannot return even to the dreadful status quo that existed a year ago.
There are people on the right in Israel who want a ban against Palestinians from the occupied territories working in Israel. What's the status of that now?
They've begun restricting the numbers of Palestinians who can enter Israel, simply those who have security records. But as always happens in countries like this with sort of oppressed and impoverished minorities, Israel has grown so dependent on Palestinian workers for sweeping the streets and cleaning, doing the dishes in restaurants and picking up the garbage and all the kinds of jobs that Israelis no longer want to do, that as much as they might like to separate the two cultures, the consequences for Israeli daily life and for the Israeli economy would be so severe in their view that I don't think they'll do it. And further, should they erect a sort of a military wall between the occupied territories and Israel itself, there's not enough income-making opportunities in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip for the population there to support itself. And so they would grow even angrier and even more desperate and even more prone to violence. And just as we can't really keep people from Mexico and Central America from slipping across our borders, Israel cannot hermetically seal the West Bank, which is a line running right through the center of the country without any fence or any marking. And if the people grew so desperate, I think the number of them who would slip into the country and create mayhem would grow even larger.
Why do you think things have gotten so bad between Israelis and Palestinians now?
Several reasons. One is that the Palestinian uprising is now 3 years old and has accomplished nothing for the Palestinians on the ground in the West Bank. They're farther from a solution in their view and in many other people's views than they ever have been. The sympathy for Saddam Hussein has given them a level of what I believe is irrational confidence that they didn't have before. And then finally the shootings at Al-Aqsa Mosque, the Temple Mount, in October enraged Palestinians and much of the world, and some of them sought revenge and achieved it. And once that started, it began a back-and-forth cycle. One day, a Palestinian would kill a couple of Israelis. The next day, an Israeli with an automatic weapon would open fire on a vehicle in the West Bank, and back and forth and back and forth. And the longer it goes on, the deeper it gets, and the more prevalent the hatred becomes.
My guest is Joel Brinkley, and he's the Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. He's ending a short visit to the States and is about to return to Israel. A few days ago, Jordan formed a new government, which includes five cabinet ministers from a militant Muslim anti-Israel group. The country's trying to become a constitutional monarchy, and Palestinians are winning positions of power within the new government. Is Jordan headed in a new political direction?
It's not quite clear where Jordan is going. I've spent a lot of time there over this fall and interviewed some of these Islamic militants, the Muslim Brotherhood, they call themselves. And King Hussein is at this moment in both the best position and the worst position he's ever been in. He's in the best position because he's never been so popular with his countrymen, but he's popular with his countrymen because he has taken their point of view as his own and therefore made himself something close to a pariah to the Western world. And I believe that he's allowing the fundamentalists and the Palestinians in his country to drag him and Jordan into ruin. So for the moment, his throne is safe, but as one American diplomat put it, he may very soon be the popular king of a completely broken country. A year ago, when they held elections and the Islamic fundamentalists won a number of seats in parliament, the king and his men managed to form a government which included none of them, because the central tenet of Islamic fundamentalism is to get rid of secular governments and replace them with Islamic governments, which says that the Islamic Brotherhood is anathema to everything that King Hussein stands for. Well, they've grown stronger and stronger, and to appease them, to keep public content at a manageable level, he's had to include them in the government. And I don't see this heading anyway but to a dark situation for the king and for Jordan.
Well, Palestinians comprise, I think, about 60% of the population in Jordan now?
There are various figures, but it's probably something close to that.
Would there be, I mean, you're suggesting that King Hussein is kind of inviting his own downfall with these elections, but, I mean, if the country's going to be moving toward democracy, would there be any way of keeping fundamentalists out of government?
He tried, and after a year, the demands grew to be so strong, and he was unable to hold off any longer. If you want to have a democracy that truly represents your people, then certainly you have to represent the Muslim fundamentalists. And the only problem is the Muslim fundamentalists don't want it, in the long term, don't want a democracy. They want a theocracy. So it's a dilemma.
What's the reaction of Jordanians to the spread of fundamentalism?
There's a very clear division. There are native Jordanians, secular native Jordanians, who despise the Islamic Brotherhood, and that might be 30% of the population. There are Palestinians who are not Islamic fundamentalists, who sympathize with them because they sort of have consistent goals. The Islamic fundamentalists want to retake Jerusalem because that's the third holiest place in Islam, and the Palestinians want to retake Jerusalem because they see that as their homeland. So many of the Islamic fundamentalists are Palestinians, and many others are sympathetic. So I think the majority of people who are Jordanian citizens, including the Palestinians, favor the goals of the Islamic fundamentalists, and the Jordanian natives are just completely disdainful of them.
How is this split in Jordan now between the fundamentalists and those who oppose the fundamentalists affecting where Jordan stands on Saddam Hussein?
Most Jordanians of every stripe are like Saddam Hussein, though the native Jordanians do not agree with the seizure of Kuwait. But Jordan is a country that has no resources of its own, and its greatest exportable product was expatriate labor that worked in the Gulf. And many Jordanians of all types, particularly Palestinians, worked in Kuwait, worked in Iraq, and worked in the Gulf, worked in Saudi Arabia. Where they were paid fairly well, but treated clearly as second-class citizens, as were the Egyptians and others. And they resented it. The Jordanians and others have this vision of one great Arab nation, even though it's now divided into what they believe are sub-nations, and they don't understand Kuwait and the others that other nations that treated them as second-class Arabs. So there was a great resentment toward Kuwait, and that helped fuel the enthusiasm for Saddam Hussein.
You've written that even Palestinians who were living in Kuwait and forced to flee after the invasion support Saddam Hussein. I find that a little difficult to understand.
It is hard to understand from afar, but you have to accept that they work by a different form of logic, if you can call it that, than we do. I've met Palestinians who have lost everything they've owned, life savings, no chance ever to recover it, and they still revere Saddam Hussein, even though it was the invasion of Kuwait that cost them everything they own. And I guess the answer is that he is the only strong man they see who seems to be working for them. Now, I think Saddam Hussein's constant repetition of the Palestinian line is merely a very clever political ploy, but the Palestinians earnestly believe that the day will come when he will stamp out the United States forces, march on, take Jerusalem, and return their homeland to them. They are among the most unrealistic dreamers I've ever encountered anywhere in the world.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Joel Brinkley. He's the Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Joel Brinkley is my guest. He's the Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. You found that there were many Palestinians in Jordan who were willing to sacrifice the country of Jordan in order to get back their homeland.
Absolutely. Most of them. Most of them care nothing for Jordan, see it as a, even if they own great homes, they see them as a refugee camp, a holding place until they can return to Palestine, as they still call it, and would happily give up Jordan in the process. If it costs the nation of Jordan to regain Palestine, they would do it in a minute.
How is the growing power of Palestinians in Jordan affecting the balance of power in the Middle East?
Well, it would only affect the balance of power in the Middle East if Jordan became a Palestinian state, which I suppose is conceivable, but not that likely in the near term. For every one of Jordan's neighbors, King Hussein's Hashemite kingdom is the best possible alternative. If there were a Palestinian state, then it would be likely that Israel eventually would have to take it on in a war which would threaten Saudi Arabia, would anger Egypt. If it were an Iraqi state, that too would threaten Saudi Arabia. So it would affect the balance of power greatly if they took over the state, but I don't think it would have much effect short of that.
King Hussein of Jordan officially supported the UN sanctions against Iraq, but where is the country perceived as actually standing now?
The king, in every circumstance, tries very hard to stand right on the edge of the fence. This time, I don't think he pulled it off completely. If you listen to his statements and take them in their pure form, he says very carefully, and he's a very careful man, that he does not support the invasion of Kuwait, believes Iraq should withdraw from Kuwait, but also believes the American and allied forces should leave Saudi Arabia. A very carefully crafted King Hussein fence-straddling position. But he allowed the people on the street, the Palestinians principally, to override this official view with their strident, angry denunciations of the West and unequivocal support of Saddam Hussein. And unfortunately, their voices were far louder than the king's, so he was overridden by his people. And that is the... And most people, understanding the sort of democracy that Jordan is, believe that the street position, as the king calls it, is really Jordan's position.
Israel is really trying to stay out of the Gulf crisis to whatever extent it can. But how does Israel stand to be changed by a war in the Gulf?
I don't think Israel will get involved in a war in the Gulf, except in this, perhaps in this slight way that we mentioned before, a few missiles and perhaps an effort to take out the missile bases. But I believe, and many people believe, that when the war is over, if the U.S. comes out of it with any position of strength, which is not altogether certain, that the United States, the Soviet Union, and others will land on Israel like a ton of bricks and try finally to force some kind of movement in the Israeli-Palestinian question. And Israelis see that, they fear that. The government that's in place right now will not move. The last time the United States tried to force a change, tried to force some movement in the peace process, it caused the government of Israel to fall. And I don't see a happy outcome of the next effort when it comes.
Joel Brinkley is my guest, Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. Joel, when you're in Israel, you know, in a marketplace or walking through the streets or whatever, what kind of debates or conversations do you hear among Israelis about what's happening now in the Gulf and about what the future might hold?
Israelis, almost to a person, want the United States to deal with Saddam Hussein. They won't publicly say, we hope the U.S. will fight a war. But to a man, they all say, you've got all these forces here. If you don't do it now, you're going to have to come back and do it later. And that's their most fervent hope, that these allied forces will finally deal with this Israel's great nemesis.
The Pentagon just issued press restrictions should there be a war in the Gulf. And the restrictions include that reporters would be in pools escorted by military personnel. There'd be a ban on TV coverage of military personnel in agony or in shock. All interviews with military men and women would have to be on the record. There would be a prohibition against impromptu interviews with military personnel. What are your responses to the press restrictions?
Well, the response of the entire national press is quite unhappy. And as always, there's the suspicion, if not certainty, that the restrictions are not a question of trying to restrict the flow of information that would be harmful to the war effort, but to restrict information that might be embarrassing to the Defense Department. And that's what all of us suspect is behind this, and so nobody's happy about it.
How would these restrictions limit your ability to do your job?
When you have... when every interview is escorted, I've done lots of interviews with military people, and if you do an escorted interview in a pool, and that means that often they'll present a set-up situation where a group of reporters is presented with a carefully chosen soldier or officer who simply offers a with his superior officer watching, he offers a very careful sanitized description of whatever it is you're asking about, and then the American public is not really informed about what's going on, and as a war is being fought, particularly a war as this one promises to be, if it occurs, that is being hotly debated in the United States, people here should have a pretty clear idea what's going on day by day as it happens, as long as the press is responsible enough not to give away plans and intentions.
How are you feeling about going back to Israel, knowing in a few days you might actually be in the middle of a war?
Again, I don't think Israel's going to be in a war. It's a little worrisome. If he fires missiles, there's a chance the missile will hit my house, but I think the chances of that are awfully remote, and I'm not particularly worried about it.
Did your editors at the Times have any words of advice for you?
Only that I can't go on vacation or leave the country again if there's a war.
Right. What about your father, David Brinkley? Did he have any advice for you if war breaks out?
Just to be careful.
Yeah.
As everyone in my family says.
Well, Joel Brinkley, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
And I wish you a good return trip to Israel.
Thank you.
And Joel Brinkley is the Jerusalem Bureau Chief for The New York Times. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. John Pizzarilli's singing calls up memories of the swing-era vocalists. His guitar playing has been influenced by a source closer to home, his father, jazz guitarist Bucky Pizzarilli. Coming up, we talk with John, and we hear more from his latest album, which we're listening to now. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums by Frauds, Vanilla Ice, and The Simpsons. And TV critic David Bianculli says in past years, some of the best new TV shows have premiered in January. He tells us what this January has in store. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
When whippoorwills call and evening is nigh, I hurry to my blue heaven. Turn to the right, there's a little white light that will lead you to...
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The president is hailing as a positive step Iraq's announcement today that it will send Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz to Geneva for a January 9th meeting with Secretary of State James Baker. During a question-and-answer period with reporters this afternoon, the president once again rejected any links between the Gulf crisis and the Palestinian issue. But the president did offer an assurance on another Iraqi concern.
I think it's been made clear to Iraq, not only by Secretary Baker, but by others, that if they totally comply, they will not be attacked. And as I have said, there will, when they totally withdraw, there still remain some problems to be solved, but they will not be under attack.
Published reports say that Iraq had asked for such an assurance when Saddam Hussein met with Algeria's president in Baghdad last month. The president will choose Agriculture Secretary Clayton Yider to be the next chair of the Republican National Committee, according to sources cited by the Associated Press. It is unclear just when the president will make his announcement. Mr. Bush had originally chosen former Drug Policy Director William Bennett to head the RNC, but Bennett withdrew his name, citing potential financial conflicts. The Republican National Committee will meet January 25th to choose a new leader and is thought to be willing to ratify the president's choice. A federal grand jury today indicted a high-ranking member of the South Carolina General Assembly. The charges stem from a federal investigation into corruption in state governments. It's been characterized as the largest political scandal in South Carolina history. From member station WLTR in Columbia, Barry Myers reports.
The U.S. Attorney's Office and the FBI have been investigating allegations of corruption within the South Carolina General Assembly for more than 6 months. To date, six lawmakers have been found guilty of violating a federal anti-bribery law. They were videotaped accepting bribes from a lobbyist working undercover for the FBI. U.S. Attorney Bart Daniel today announced Speaker Pro Tem Jack Rogers has been indicted on bribery and extortion charges. U.S. Attorney Bart Daniel.
It is a substantial yet fragile trust that we place in our elected officials. And most officials, that fragile trust is protected by some. It has been shattered.
Three more South Carolina lawmakers go on trial later this month, and the U.S. attorney says more indictments are expected in the coming months. For National Public Radio, I'm Barry Myers reporting from Columbia, South Carolina.
In Rhode Island, some Rhode Islanders who are stranded without money may soon see some relief. Governor Bruce Sundlin, who closed 45 credit unions and small banks on New Year's Day, is completing an emergency plan to let some money from the banks dribble out. 22 credit unions have been approved for federal deposit insurance. On Wall Street, stock prices were mixed today. The Dow average lost nearly 7.5 points to close at 2566.09. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Two of the most popular records released at the end of 1990 were debut albums by the TV cartoon family The Simpsons and the white rapper Vanilla Ice. The Simpsons sold more than 1 million copies in its first week, and Vanilla Ice has already sold 5 million. Rock critic Ken Tucker expects the success of these two records to continue in 91.
I'm back, and I'm ringing the bell. I'm rocking on the mic while the fly girls yell. In ecstasy in the back of me. Well, that's my DJ T-shirt. Cutting all them Z's. He's hitting hard, and the girl is going crazy. Vanilla's on the mic, man. I'm not lazy. I'm
Let us now praise a couple of frauds. Vanilla Ice and The Simpsons are, in their various ways, complete fakes who've brought pleasure to millions. Vanilla Ice is actually a Miami kid in his 20s named Robbie Van Winkle. Personally, if I had a name like Robbie Van Winkle, I'd keep it. Anyway, Vanilla Ice has scored a number one hit his first time out with this single, Ice Ice Baby.
All right, stop, collaborate and listen. Ice is back with my brand new invention. Something grabs a hold of me tightly, flow like a harpoon daily and nightly.
Will it ever stop?
Yo, I don't know. Turn off the lights and I'll glow to the
extreme. I rock a mic like a vandal. Light up a stage and wax a chump like a candle. Dance, crush the speaker that booms. I'm killing your brain like a poisonous mushroom. Deadly, when I play a dope melody. Anything less than the best is a felony. Love it or leave it, you better gain weight. You better hit bullseye, the kid don't play. If there was a problem, yo, I'll solve it. Check out the hook while my DJ revolves it.
That song has an instrumental hook you might recognize. It's the guitar riff from Under Pressure, a decade-old song written by Queen and David Bowie. As you can hear, Vanilla Ice is a pretty ordinary rapper. To his credit, he doesn't try to disguise the fact that he's white. To his discredit, his phrasing is kind of wooden and lame. But he's a terrific dancer, and like so many white artists working in black genres, he gets a lot of unwarranted credit just because he can do it at all. Ice has spent the last few months telling little white lies, that he went to school with Two Live Crew's Luther Campbell, they attended the same school but not during the same years, that he's won a number of nationwide motocross racing championships, he won a few regional competitions, nothing national, and that he was once in a gang fight and lost half his blood. He's given two different cities as the site of this putative tragedy, and his mother, with whom he is apparently very close, claims to have no knowledge of such a life-threatening experience. Oh well, it's only rock and roll or rap.
Girl, let your feet move free. Want to move through the groove of Vanilla Ice. You come here to run and let the white boy rap. If you're a hoe, get off my lap. Cause Ice stands for being so cold. That's a nickname I got for being so bold. Jerome stands for MPA, my personal assistant every day. I'm not an MC to come here to play. Yeah, boy, I'm serious. I'm going all the way. Rhymes are clean, there's no need to be ill. And when I'm on the mic, I let them all spill.
As for The Simpsons, well, like everyone from Lorne Greene to Leonard Nimoy, The Simpsons are TV stars who've decided to cash in on their popularity by cutting a record. And true to the winning streak these top-rated cartoon characters are on, they've got a hit single. If, like me, you have young children in your house, the song you hear played most often is probably this one.
Yo, hey, what's happening, dude? I'm a guy with a rep for being rude, terrorizing people wherever I go. It's not intentional, just keeping the flow. Test scores to get the best scores. Dropping banana peels all over the floor. I'm the kid that made the delinquency an art. Last name Simpson, first name Bart. I'm here today to introduce the next phase. The next step in the big Bart craze. I got a dance real easy to do. I learned it with no rhythm and so can you. Ooh, so move your body if you got the notion. Front to back in a rock-like motion. Now that you got it, if you think you can, do it through the music, that's the Bart man.
Everybody, if you can, do the Bart man. Shake your body, turn it out if you can.
Kick it out, man.
Back to the side, yes, you can. Everybody in the house, do the Bart man.
Everything about this Simpsons album is wrong, but turns out right anyway. It's called The Simpsons Sing the Blues, but most of its best stuff is rap and rock music. The vocals are performed by the actors who do the voices for the TV show, but they do remarkably well as singers. Dan Castellaneta, for example, who supplies the voice for the perennially aggrieved dad Homer, does an all-too-believable job as a white blues singer on The Simpsons version of Born Under a Bad Sign.
I don't like to read. I can hardly write. My whole life has been one big fight. Born under a bad sign. I've been down since I began to crawl. If it wasn't for bad luck, I said I wouldn't have no luck at all. And that ain't no lie.
Yes, that really is B.B. King supplying the guitar line for that song. The Simpsons Sing the Blues is otherwise chock-full of Los Angeles session hacks and features a few dreadful cuts, such as yet another version of Randy Newman's sappy I Love to See You Smile. But as a novelty ripoff, it's well done, and like the show itself, frequently manages to capture the cynical spirit of its times.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly.
Those idiots.
Oh, look at all those boobs.
An office full of morons.
A factory full of fools.
Is it any wonder
I'm singing, singing the blues? What happened? Where are the
the instruments.
I believe they call us breakdowns, sir.
I can't have any breakdowns here. What if there was an inspector around? Play a guitar.
This is Fresh Air. Guitarist and singer John Pizzarelli is in good company on his new record, My Blue Heaven. Clark Terry is on trumpet, Dave McKenna piano, Milt Hinton bass, Connie Kay drums, and John's father, Bucky Pizzarelli, on guitar. These are some of the musicians John grew up listening to. In fact, some of them played with his father and were guests at the house. John got started playing guitar duets with his father. Now that John also sings, he's become part of the New York cabaret scene. He opens at the Algonquin Hotel January 8th. The new album features mostly standards. Here's a song by one of John's favorite singers, Nat King Cole.
Here's something that I'd like to bring to you, wrapped all in cellophane designed for you. A 2, 3, 4. Tell you what it's all about. It is without a doubt swinging in the latest style. Service with a smile. If you want to swing and shout, get your kicks and get about. I'm an errand boy of rhythm. Send me, well, lace your boots and follow through. I'll deliver straight to you. I'm an errand boy for rhythm. Send me, well, you can always find me down at Smokey Joe's. That's the place where every gal and gator goes. If you want variety, just step in and call for me. I'm an errand boy for rhythm. Send me.
You won the Manhattan Association of Clubs and Cabarets Best Male Jazz Award. So you've been performing at cabarets. I'm sure you've also performed at some jazz clubs. What's the difference between the two scenes, the cabaret scene and the jazz scene?
Actually, in the cabaret, I think in the cabaret scene, I think what you really have to do is present the songs and give a story and set everything up. There's more time, you know, there's people sort of understand that, I feel, in the cabaret setting. In the jazz setting, it's sort of taken for granted that you can just go and play and express yourself, you know, and everyone will, you know, you don't have to introduce anything, which is sort of the fallback with jazz. I sort of like playing jazz in the cabaret scene because you can talk about things and they expect you to do it. It's not, there's no preconceptions as to what, you know, they're supposed to do. When the jazz player, sometimes I'll go to hear a jazz player and they don't even talk to me, you know, they don't say anything, tell what the songs are, they just play and expect you to take it all in. I'd rather know what the songs are, why they're playing it, or, you know, what are they doing up there? That's what I like about the cabaret scene.
In a way, your singing reminds me of some of the vocals that you'd hear on largely instrumental records, where an instrumentalist would sing a number. Do you know what I mean?
Like the
like Hot Lips Page would do like one song,
right?
On
sure.
Record, yeah. And there were often, like, you know, light songs.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're right. That's the style, I guess, in that I sing, and it's more of a musician singing as opposed to a singer singing.
You know? Right, right. Did singing help get you out of your father's shadow, in the sense that you were doing something that was different than what he did?
Yes, definitely. And it's always, he's a great guitar soloist and a great guitarist in general. And to be able to do something that's my own is something that's important to me. To be known for being a singer is something that I'm not as good a guitar player as he is. And there aren't many people who are, but it's good to be able to do something other than have to be, he's like a guitar player like his father, you know. I'm glad that I can, that's why I like to sing, too. It separates us.
So early in your career, you felt that you were in his shadow at times?
Yeah, a lot. When we worked together back in the early 80s, our first gig was, we did 8 weeks at the Pierre Hotel. He had a group there for about a couple of years, and in the summer, he had taken off. Well, this one summer, I think it was 1980 or 81, they said, why don't you stay on and do the summer with your son? And, you know, his piano and bass player took the summer off, and I did it with them. two guitars, and I only knew about 7 songs. And it was an aggravating summer because it was just, you know, on-the-job training, and he accepted all requests, and you learned everything while you were going, and it just became, it was aggravating because I was learning and not enjoying as much as I was learning. It paid off in the end, but we had a lot of fights and everything that summer, in particular, when we were just starting.
Fights about music or fights about other things?
Fights about, music too, in the sense that I wasn't playing a lot of solos on songs. I was just learning the chords and letting him do everything. And in the end, that also worked out because I ended up learning a lot more chords to songs and can play them with singers. Then I know a lot of my friends can, you know, and it actually worked out better, but I used to say, why don't you let me solo a little? And I'd play like 1 or 2 solos a night in a 4-hour period, and that would be about it. And that was aggravating when I was young, but now I know he made the right decision.
You play a duet with your father on the new record on Don't Get Around Much Anymore.
Right.
I want to play some of that. Tell us who's playing which part here.
Okay. The opening melody of the song is played by my father. And then I play the first solo. You can actually hear me grunting and breathing and doing all sorts of weird things. It's the way they record it. The microphone is actually in front of my nose, I think. I actually started playing guitar in 6th grade, so I must have been about 10 or 11 years old. I actually played banjo, tenor banjo first. My uncles were tenor banjo players from Paterson, New Jersey. And when I was about 7, my father, it's the only time he ever told me I was going to do anything. he had a banjo, his father's banjo, and said, you're going to learn from your uncles how to play the banjo. You start tomorrow and that's that. So I went down to the music store where my uncle Bobby Dominic was teaching and learned how to play the tenor banjo, and I would play duets with them. I learned songs like Bye Bye Blues and Bye Bye Blackbird. Anything that began with Bye Bye was basically what I would learn first.
So how did you switch from banjo to guitar?
I sort of didn't play the banjo for a while. After about 2 or 3 years, I just sort of didn't practice and things, and then I found the guitar was there were always guitars out on the couch in the house. There's always a guitar in every room, you know, laying in a corner or something, and decided to apply the things that I knew on the banjo to the guitar. And I opened up, I remember, as if it were yesterday, I played, they had the Elton John songbook, and I looked at the dots and everything and put my fingers on the guitar neck where they're supposed to be, and I played, the song was Country Comfort, if you remember that one. And just decided to teach myself how to play guitar. And I just went on from there. I really never took any lessons from my dad because we didn't have the patience for each other, really.
I'm sure you grew up with rock and roll as well as with jazz. What do you think it was that got you to head in the direction of jazz instead of rock?
As I'd like to say employment, because I was working with my father a lot. But I think that's what it was. I think I enjoyed working with my dad, and that's what he did. If he were a rock and roller, I would have played rock and roll. And I enjoyed, we worked a lot. And that's what kept me busy. And I loved it. Right after I came from college in 1980, about a year later, we were opening for Benny Goodman around the country. We did about 8 or 9 dates in the year. And it was a thrill to see the King of Swing every night, you know, be on a plane with him and do things. And it was a lot of interesting experiences like that. And I just enjoyed being around all those people. Everybody that I was around, that my father knew, they were really greats. You know, when I saw Clark Terry and Milt Hinton as a child, and these were big guys. You knew who these guys were, they write encyclopedias and they start with those guys, you know. Zoot Sims is one of the great tenor saxophone players. So to be around those people was thrilling, and that's what kept me in jazz. I mean, I met so many of those guys, you know, just to try and be like them is what I wanted to do.
This album is the first album I've heard you scat on?
Pretty much, yeah. It's actually the first album I do my entire arsenal of musical tricks. And for example, on Errand Boy for Rhythm, Clark Terry didn't, like, on certain songs, Clark just left the room. You know, we'd just, like, finish a take, and they say that was good, then Clark never would come back. So I was wondering where he was for Errand Boy for Rhythm as it was. So that one, I ended up playing a longer guitar solo than I thought. On another one, That's What, is one where it's actually sort of a, I like that song because Oscar Moore and Nat Cole wrote. Oscar Moore was Nat Cole's guitar player, and on the record, Nat scats the melody, and Oscar Moore plays it. And on this song, I have to play it and scat it at the same time. My father always likes that too. He says, "Do that scatting thing you do. I like that."
Guitarist and singer John Pizzarelli. His new album, My Blue Heaven, is on Chesky. From January 8th until February 3rd, John Pizzarelli performs at the Algonquin Hotel in New York. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, Iraq has agreed to meet with the United States. What do you have on that?
We're going to spend some time on it, Terry, and come at it from several angles. First of all, the meeting itself, what we think will happen there, what Iraq thinks will happen there. It's between Secretary of State Baker and Iraq's Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz. We'll also look at a French proposal offering to Baghdad a conference on other Middle East issues if they will pull out. And we'll have the ambassador from Iraq to the United States here to tell us Baghdad's view.
Thanks, Linda. Then and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Every January, to replace the TV series that have failed since the fall, the networks begin to unveil what they call a second season of premieres. TV critic David Bianculli says he usually looks forward to this time of year, but not this year.
I like it when the networks do their annual pre-spring cleaning. What usually happens is that the weakest series from the previous fall are replaced by the strongest, or at least the strangest, new entries for the new year. The second season is when the networks first presented The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd and Quantum Leap and, last year, The Simpsons and Twin Peaks. It's also when they presented America's Funniest Home Videos, but you get the point. Anyway, I expected this second season to be really daring and different, to make up for what was a depressingly mediocre fall season. So what do we get instead? Some of the new shows are just new episodes of old ones. Equal Justice is back, and so are Seinfeld, Real Life with Jane Pauley, and the Western series Paradise, which is back with a new title, Guns of Paradise. The best TV event of the month is a rerun. CBS is repeating Lonesome Dove. The biggest event, but by no means the best, is likely to be NBC's remake of Dark Shadows, a new version of a bad 25-year-old soap opera. There's also a sitcom starring Farrah Fawcett and Ryan O'Neal, and a couple of dramas that are too much, way too much, like 30-something. One of them, called Sons and Daughters, tries to show what might happen when the 30-something crowd gets a bit closer to 40-something. It's got a large cast, but the focus of the premiere episode is Lucy Arnaz, who opens the show by opening her door and coming face-to-face with an instant crisis.
Yeah, how do you do? My name is Lillian Park. I'm so pleased to finally meet you.
Really?
Please, look at these.
Portland General Hospital, Mount Holly Adoption Society. What's all this about?
Your little girl, Astrid. You adopted her from Mount Holly, didn't you?
No. Yes, no. Who are you?
I believe I may be Astrid's mother.
The other Family in Crisis series is called Undercover. It's got good credentials. The stars are Anthony Davison from Crime Story and Wise Guy and Linda Pearl, and the show comes from the creators of China Beach. But boy, is it dumb. It's about a suburban family where the parents just happen to be CIA spies, and where the father is likely to slip away from his son's school softball game to sneak into the classroom and meet with a KGB contact.
Your son, he should choke up more.
Everybody's a coach. How do you know from baseball?
I became a Yankees fan when I was at the UN. The way George Steinbrenner runs that team. Very Russian.
More like the Chinese, I'd say. You guys have gotten soft.
Be careful, my friend. We still have old men who dream of Deng and blood.
This show should have been called Married Spies with Children, and it shouldn't have been made. And even though Sons and Daughters isn't awful, and the parents aren't spies, it's a long way from good. This is the point in the primetime relay race where things are supposed to pick up speed. But the networks just dropped the baton.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Our reviews are produced by Naomi Person. Our interviews are produced by Phyllis Myers and Amy Sallet, with production assistance from Roberta Shurrock and Joan Tuohy. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Richard Loeb discusses the difficulties of raising kids in the 90s. And we talk with actor Joe Morton, co-star of the series Equal Justice, which is about to return to TV. Morton was also the extraterrestrial in John Sayles' film, The Brother from Another Planet. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.